This is Law and Disorder.
In a stunning verdict, the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals recently ruled that Sheikh Mohammed Ali Al-Moyad and Mohammed Zayed, convicted of supporting terrorists, may have new trials.
The Court of Appeals, in a very good sign for Lynn Stewart, has ruled that the government either has to let him go or retry him.
The terrorist Luis Posada Carriles remains free on the streets of Miami. Today we'll bring you excerpts from a recent discussion at New York University School of Law on Posada's crimes.
This longtime CIA employee has been coddled by this government and not sent back to Venezuela, where he should be tried for crimes against humanity. What's going on in Iraq is a story that's basically fallen off the front page. Today we're going to talk with Chris Hedges, author of Collateral Damage, America's War Against Iraqi Civilians.
If you think there's any solution but the U.S. getting out of Iraq, you will know you are wrong once you hear Chris Hedges.
Stay with us. The Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled recently that Sheikh Mohammed Ali Al-Moyad and Mohammed Mohsen Zayed, convicting of supporting terrorists, can have new trials. The men were convicted in federal court in Brooklyn after a six-week trial in early 2005 on charges of conspiring to support Al-Qaeda and Hamas, supporting the Palestinian group, and attempting to support Al-Qaeda. A three-judge panel ordered the transfer of the case to a new judge. The appeals court also said the government testimony in the case was inflammatory, referring to projecting large images of Osama bin Laden and his top aide for the jury to see. Their trial also featured testimony by an FBI informant who set himself on fire outside the White House, demanding more money from the government. We have with us today Robert Boyle, a National Lawyers Guild attorney who represented Sheikh Mohammed Ali Al-Moyad, and ex-civil rights attorney and convicted felon Lynn Stewart, who tells us why this brings other issues to light. Welcome, Bob and Lynn, to Law and Disorder.
It was a really striking, stunning victory that you had on the appeal of your two clients. Tell us about the case and what was at stake.
Well, this case involved a FBI sting operation where the FBI, and in association actually with the Department of Justice itself, lured my client Mohammed Al-Moyad and his driver and assistant Mohammed Zayed from their native Yemen to Germany on the promise that, and this was on the basis of an FBI informant telling them this, that they would provide hundreds of thousands of dollars to Sheikh Al-Moyad's charitable organizations in Yemen. In Yemen, he's known as the father of the poor and runs a charitable bakery and a lot of other charitable operations, if he would also see to it that a portion of that money went to Hamas. Now, Hamas is a legal organization in Yemen, gets government support. So the issue in the case here was, of course, entrapment. This was all set up by the FBI. Shortly after 9/11, within 2 months of 9/11, a man named Mohammed Al-Ansi walked into the FBI headquarters in Washington and said, "I know terrorist people in the Arab countries, people who support terrorism. And if you give me money, I will, you know, set these people up." So they employed him, eventually paying him hundreds of thousands of dollars, although he expected up to $5 million, and he set up this sting operation. He was an associate of many people. So Sheikh Al-Moyad was lured to Germany, arrested there in early 2003 after these meetings with the informant and someone else were on tape, and brought to trial here in Brooklyn, had never set foot in the United States. And all of a sudden, he's on a plane and winds up in the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn.
Tell us about his co-defendant.
His co-defendant, Mohammed Zayed, was a friend of the family, someone who worked in the charitable bakery, and agreed to accompany Sheikh Al-Moyad to Germany because one of the reasons he wanted to go to Germany, Sheikh Al-Moyad did, not only for this meeting, was that he is extremely ill with diabetes and other ailments and wanted to get treatment. in Germany, and a lot of people from that area go to Germany for medical treatment. And Zayed's only role was to accompany Sheikh al-Moayad on this trip to be his assistant.
How did the trial go down? How did they get the convictions?
Well, the trial went down. They played, obviously, surveillance tapes. The defense, though, in this case was entrapment, which means that there was really not a lot of dispute that of what happened in Germany, that there was this conversation about, we'll give you all of this money if you help us do this. The issue was Sheikh al-Moayad predisposed to do this absent the government's conduct?
Well, and that's always the issue on these entrapment cases.
Yes.
Yeah.
But in this case, the prong of inducement was not contested. The government agreed that he was induced to come to Germany. So in terms of the prong of predisposition, had he done this before, the trial judge permitted the government to introduce a whole host of prejudicial and irrelevant evidence, such as, for example, a man who testified who allegedly attended an Al-Qaeda training camp in Afghanistan, and he was permitted to describe the training camp and play for the jury a tape of a speech by Osama bin Laden, only because after the invasion of Afghanistan, a lot of documents were seized there, brought to the United States, we don't know how, and on one of the documents was written Sheikh al-Moayad's name as a person who may have recommended someone at some point to attend this camp. But yet they introduced, we don't know who that person was, they introduced a speech by Osama bin Laden. They introduced evidence of a tragic bus bombing in Tel Aviv in 2002, where some people were killed. One of the victims of that bombing testified, showed pictures of the bombing, described where his cousin was blown up to pieces with blood all over the bus. And there was no connection, said the court, between that bombing and Sheikh al-Moayad. It was only admitted on the theory of the jury should know what organizations like Hamas do.
No connection. But the trial judge let that in.
Trial judge let that in on I still don't understand, on the ear theory of that it showed his predisposition. But even the appellate court, which we know in terrorism cases is loath to reverse convictions, found it prejudicial.
I attended Lynn Stewart's trial, and Lynn is sitting here in the room with us and is going to speak in a second. But what about the huge blown-up photographs of Osama bin Laden that they used in your case?
Oh, yeah, well, it's extremely similar. If you don't have the goods in terms of direct evidence, prejudice the jury. Show them, raise the specter of Osama bin Laden, raise the specter of an actual act of violence, even if it has nothing to do with the charges on trial, and you hope that the jury overlooks the weaknesses in the government's case and convicts.
Lynn, how does that relate to your case?
Well, as you mentioned, Michael, they, of course, used Osama, and we know that there is a government directive from the U.S. Attorney's Office to get Osama into every terrorism case, whether he belongs there or not. It's like, this is the face of terrorism, and if you see this in the courtroom, you can assume these people are guilty. Even though our judge did instruct the jury they were not to use that evidence against me, but as I've said many times, you can't throw a skunk in the jury box and say don't smell it.
Yeah.
The other thing, though, which not a lot of people are aware of because it happened very early in the trial, was that the judge did allow them to go into the full details of the Luxor massacre. This occurred many years before our conspiracy even was alleged to have begun. It always was questionable whether the Sheikh's group had anything whatsoever to do with it.
That's your client.
My client, who I was linked to, of course, in the case. But they allowed a person who was there to talk at great length about crouching behind the sarcophagus and fearing for his life and the gunfire all around him. This was clearly very similar to this other massacre that Bob is talking about. So we're hopeful. Of course, we're reading tea leaves because we haven't had a decision in my case. But when I say we're hopeful that this is some kind of sign that maybe the things that we raised that we thought were so prejudicial that they outweighed any possible probative, we basically say it had no probative value whatsoever, and that it will be reversed on that basis and other bases.
But Lynn and Bob, isn't it true that in this type of case, the court on appeal rarely finds that cumulative prejudicial evidence is grounds for reversal?
They rarely do, and it's one of the gratifying things about this decision that was unique. It's rare to get a reversal in any case where there's alleged terrorism. You know, I hope that this is a helpful not only to Lynn's case, but to other prosecutions, and will on some extent put maybe the government on notice that they have to rein them in.
I think stunning also, Bob, on that about putting people on notice is the fact that the court did not send it back, that they directed it should not go back to the trial judge. I mean, that's unprecedented in my experience.
Yeah, it's a humiliation.
I mean, it's like saying, you blew this, you did this wrong. And of course, Sterling Johnson has a reputation all of his own, which we won't even go into here. That was what was stunning. And I did want to mention just briefly, Heidi, that this summer I was instrumental in setting up something called the Muslim Innocence Project, which is a group of good-thinking people who wish to defend innocent Muslims who are caught in these kind of traps. And they've set up an email listserv, and they also are amassing material to be of aid to lawyers so that people will know, first of all, to be on guard for this kind of Osama thing. I think if a trial judge heard they do this in every case, they might think differently about it than just to have it sprung on them in the course of trial. So that's the Muslim Innocence Project, and it's at lists at riseup.net.
Didn't you say they changed their name, Lynn?
They did, but that's their email address.
Okay.
Their name is now Project Salam. That's not their official name, but that's their listserv name.
I wanted to ask both Lynn and Bob about the human costs of these fake prosecutions. I know in your case, Lynn, you were one of the really fine, humane criminal defense lawyers in the city. And they've taken that away from your clients. They've taken your livelihood away. You're now disbarred because you're a convicted felon. And I know in your case, Bob, both these gentlemen have put in a horrible prison. And I understand that the younger defendant has really had a terrible time of it, and that the older man, because he's in such ill health, has also had a terrible time. Tell us what the practical consequences were of this conviction to these two innocent people.
Well, I mean, I think you described it succinctly. I mean, my client is 60 years old. I was criticized by my sister for saying in the New York Times that was elderly. but he's 60 years old and suffers from diabetes, from liver complications, and is not well. And he was a man in Yemen who I said earlier, you know, ran charities, was called Father of the Poor. At his sentencing, everyone from the right-wing parties in Yemen to the Yemeni socialist group wrote letters in support of him and praising him and praising Zayed as well. And they were removed from their families. I mean, he's, like I said before, neither he nor Zayed have ever been in this country before. And all of a sudden, they're in a prison, supermax in Florence, Colorado, totally removed from their culture, their people, and everything. And so that's, you know, particularly severe. But, you know, on practical levels, as you mentioned, you know, losing a lawyer such as Lynn, who has been outspoken in defense of these rights, is also sufficiently egregious.
Bob, what's next in this case? Is there a possibility of the government appealing?
The government can ask the court to reconsider its decision or go to the Supreme Court. Barring those things, they would either have to bring Sheikh Al-Mayyad and Zayed to a second trial or dismiss these charges. And we would say that given all of the circumstances here, and particularly on just humanitarian grounds, that these charges should be dismissed to let these two men go home.
So they remain incarcerated right
They're
now?
They're still at the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. That has not changed.
Thank you, Bob Boyle, Lynn Stewart. Today, October 8th, we're celebrating Lynn Stewart's 69th birthday. We want to give a shout out to the audience out there because I know they're with us and wishing her a very happy and healthy and many more. Thanks so much for being on Law and Disorder.
We go now to hear excerpts from speeches held at Luis Posada Carriles, a tribunal, at New York University Law School. Speakers included Jane Franklin, historian and author, Wayne Smith, senior fellow from the Center for International Policy, and Brian Becker, director of the Answer Coalition. The event was moderated by our own Michael Stephen Smith. We now hear from Wayne Smith, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Let's have a listen.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I was in Havana when we broke relations back in 1961. I arrived there in August of 1958 as third secretary of embassy. Was there until Castro gave the speech January the 2nd, and we broke relations on January the 3rd. As we sailed out of the harbor mouth the next night, January the 4th, I promised myself that I would be with the first group of American diplomats back in. I thought it'd be, you know, 3-4 years maybe. Well, 16 years later, I was with the first group back in under the Carter administration. And what a disappointment. It began well. We were beginning to negotiate terms for compensating American property owners whose properties had been nationalized and a schedule for lifting the embargo. But then Brzezinski gave a press conference. Well, it wasn't actually a press conference. He had breakfast with 4 or 5 newspaper guys. Said that because of the recent and dramatic Cuban troop buildup in Angola, the normalization process was at an end. Now, what? What is this about? So I started calling around. There was no recent and dramatic buildup. The only thing that had happened was that the CIA had revised upward their estimate of how many troops were in Angola. There were no more troops the day he gave the statement than there had been the day before. But on the basis of that, the normalization process really pretty well came to an end. And it was never resumed. We never got it going again. We kept the intersections, we had talks, but the momentum was lost at that point, and it's never really been regained. I was there, I went back, I was with the first group back in, and then became the chief of mission, the chief of the intersection in 1979. 1982, I couldn't take any more of the Reagan administration. I mean, it was so deceitful, and we obviously were not going to move to improve relations with Cuba. So I sent in my cable asking to be removed from the post and given a job unrelated to policy until such time as I could take early retirement, which was then only a few months away. And as I did go into retirement, I made another one of those promises you make to yourself that I wouldn't really retire to that sailboat and start around the world until there were normal relations between Cuba and the United States. Well, 26 years have now passed, and I think I'm not going to retire to the sailboat, and certainly I'm not going to start around the world. I am mildly optimistic at this point that if Obama is elected, we may indeed begin to move toward a more normal relationship. Let's hope so. The relationship that exists between Cuba and the United States at this point is utterly nonsensical. It is not in the interest of the United States. It is not an honorable or productive policy. And it must be changed. Well, I say that, but who knows? More years may go by before it's changed. I'm not really here this evening to condemn or to sentence, let's say, Luis Posada Carriles. I think Jane has done a very good job of that. The evidence against him, of course, is massive. There's no question that he is guilty. I've left a study over here which cites some of the dozens of documents, FBI and CIA documents, that are available and make it perfectly clear that he is indeed guilty. And there are hundreds of others that haven't been released to the public. And then there was an interview in the New York Times with Annie Bardak in which he acknowledged his role in the bombings of the hotels, which resulted in the death of the Italian tourist. And he said to Annie that he didn't lose any sleep over that. The guy just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. Well, you know, that's a pretty blasé way of looking at the death of a human being. But then, on the other hand, you know, as they're reporting, the two guys who planted the bombs on the Cubana flight are calling to tell Posada the deed is done. The message they left was that a bus with 73 dogs just went over the cliff and all were killed. 73 dogs. What a nice way of putting it. And then there's the episode Jane has mentioned in which they were going to blow up the auditorium in Panama. There have been hundreds of Panamanian students there. Imagine the carnage of that if they had succeeded. Posada Cardiles, without any question, is guilty, and yet the Bush administration does not prosecute him for terrorism, even though they've got abundant evidence. It's actually sheltering him. And let me say that the Bush administration is not the first one to do this. All U.S. governments have sheltered Posada, but I think the Bush administration in some ways is the most flagrant. It's the worst of the lot. Now, how did he come to be here at this point, now freely walking the streets of Miami? Well, in November of 2000, he was arrested in Panama along with the accomplices who were going to blow up the auditorium. A Panamanian court convicted the four terrorists, not of terrorism, but of other minor crimes. And then in August 26th of 2004, in one of her last acts as president, Mireya Moscoso pardoned them all, the Posada and his three accomplices. As it turns out, she pardoned them in blatant violation of Panamanian law, but nonetheless did pardon them. Why did she pardon them? At the request of the former American ambassador to Panama, a Cuban-American, and also at the request of Ileana Ross Leitanen, a congresswoman from Miami. Also, Lincoln Diaz-Balart and Mario Diaz-Balart, the other two Cuban-American congressmen from the area of Miami. So they're pardoned, they're released. Posada's three accomplices, who are all Cuban-Americans, flew directly to Miami to a huge ceremony, a hero's welcome. Posada Cardiles, who is neither U.S. citizen nor Cuban-American, bided his time. He went, I think, to Honduras and spent several months. But in March of 2005, he showed up in Miami also and applied for asylum. He lived there for weeks openly in Miami, and the U.S. government did nothing to apprehend him, didn't raise a hand. In May of 2005, Venezuela requested Posada's preventive detention for the purpose of extraditing. They wanted to extradite him back to Venezuela to stand trial for the murders of the people killed in the Cubana flight. The Department of Homeland Security took no action whatever on the extradition request and no action against Posada. Here he is in Miami. Everyone knows he's there. He's not hiding. They did absolutely nothing. Only when Posada Cardiles himself, I don't know whether he was just goading them, maybe he really wanted to be arrested, or who knows. But Posada Cardiles holds a press conference in which he says that the Department of Homeland Security is not even looking for him. Well, at that point, they decided they had little choice but to take him into custody. So carefully loading him into a golf cart, not handcuffing him or anything like that, they take him into custody and drive him away, eventually to El Paso. Venezuela, meanwhile, did continue to press for his extradition. So he asked for protection under the Convention Against Torture. And sure enough, they organized a hearing in El Paso. They only called one witness, Joaquin Chafardet. Joaquin Chafardet, Venezuelan, and he testifies that without any question, Posada Carriles would be tortured if he were sent to Venezuela. Now, Joaquin Chafardet has been a friend and accomplice, we can say, a companion, a co-businessman with Posada for 40 years. That's one of his closest friends. And they call him to testify? I mean, what kind of a witness is that? So, but in any event, of course, the judge didn't question it. Yes, absolutely. Obviously, he'd be tortured if sent back to Venezuela. And so he was not sent back to Venezuela. January the 11th, the Bush of 2007, the Bush administration finally indicted Posada on seven counts, not of terrorism, seven counts of immigration fraud. He had given false statements on his form as he filled out to enter the United States, lying on an immigration form. I think the thing was they were using this charge to fend off the Venezuelan, not that they were going to honor it anyway, but give them some reason for fending off the Venezuelan extradition request. The judge, however, this Judge Cardone in El Paso, I've never met her, but she must be a very interesting woman because she dismissed the charges. She, and very angrily, she said this was sort of a subversion of the law and it was nonsense, and she dismissed the charges. Government immediately appealed the decision, her decision, but meanwhile, Posada was released and goes to Miami, and he's been there ever since, freely walking the streets of Miami. They've had these big parties for him at the 500 Club and I'm sure at the Fontainebleau and the Versailles, lots of parties for Posada Carriles and his friend Orlando Bosch, who I'll come to in a minute. I think this Posada Carriles case really reveals U.S. government misconduct at the highest level. Its failure to extradite or prosecute him for terrorism is an open violation of Resolution 1373 of the U.N.'s National Security Council. This is a resolution that President George W. Bush himself pushed through to enactment in the days following the terrorist attacks on 9/11. And now we just ignore it. Now, there is new activity. Posada Carriles has been walking the streets of Miami, a free man, but June the 30th of this year, the Panamanian Supreme Court overturned the pardon granted to him back in 2004 by outgoing President Mireya Moscoso because it was illegal. And in August of this year, the Panamanian Vice President Samuel Luis Navarro indicated that Panama would soon request the U.S. to extradite Posada to Panama to serve out the remaining 4 years of his term. Now, this would place the U.S. in a difficult position. We don't care about Venezuela. We don't mind offending them. We have bad relations with them anyway. Panama is another thing. We have reasonably good relations with Panama, and we don't want to offend its president. So what do we do? Well, only days later, suddenly this appeals court in New Orleans, which has been dormant, you know, the appeal is filed, and they haven't said a word. All of a sudden, the appeals court in New Orleans comes to life, and they say that Posada Carriles indeed will have to be the Judge Cardone's dismissal of the charges for immigration fraud, lying on your entry form, that has been overturned, and now he will have to stand trial in El Paso for immigration fraud. Well, he wouldn't have much to fear because he's already served more time than is called for by the charge. So even if he's tried, he supposedly would be immediately released. Now, if this were done straightforwardly and honestly, it might not be much of a hindrance. In other words, he'd be taken to El Paso, tried, and then released because he's already served his time. And then the Panamanian extradition could take place, and he could be extradited to Panama if it were done straightforwardly. But looking at the record, looking at the case, does anyone think it would be done straightforwardly? I think you can look now and see. They say back in June, they said that he'd have to be tried in El Paso. Well, 2 months have gone by. They still haven't even set a date for the trial. The likely thing is that, and the plan almost certainly is, to use this to evade the Panamanian extradition request. It can drag on forever. Posada Cardiles will be there in El Paso, but handled very comfortably, and it will never be extradited to Panama. Perhaps, let's see, but my bet is on that. My bet is that it will not be handled straightforwardly. It will be handled dishonestly. He will not be extradited to Panama. Now, this isn't the first time that the Bush family, at the behest of Ileana Ross Leighton, has protected terrorists. Back in 1987, Orlando Bosch, let me add here, they were involved in this, the downing of the plane, and then both Orlando Bosch and Posada Cardiles were in prison in Venezuela. Orlando Bosch mysteriously disappears, probably paid somebody off, and Posada escapes. Where does Posada go? He goes up to El Salvador to work for Oliver North in the Iran-Contra thing. It's mind-boggling. It really is. How could we possibly associate with these people? But the Orlando Bosch mysteriously gets out of prison at the same time. He comes to Florida, and without a visa. The Immigration and Naturalization Service was moving to deport him. And the Assistant Attorney General, the Associate Attorney General, back in 1989, said, "The security of this nation is affected by its ability to credibly urge other nations to refuse aid and shelter to terrorists. We cannot shelter Dr. Bosch and maintain that credibility." Okay, that's a very straightforward statement. But shelter him we did, urged by Congresswoman Ileana Ross and Jeb Bush, then managing her election campaign. President George H.W. Bush approved a pardon for Bosch, who has since 1989, has lived unrepentant and comfortably in Miami. Jeb Bush, of course, went on to become governor of the state. Now, as I said, I'm not here to sentence Posada. He's guilty, everyone knows it, and no more need be said. I'm here to sentence the Bush family. Now, let me say, George W. Bush has often said, as Jane mentioned, has often said that anyone who aids a terrorist is a terrorist. Well, by that standard, George W. Bush, Jeb Bush, and yes, George H.W. Bush are all terrorists. And so most certainly is Congresswoman Ileana Ross. Thank you.
That was Wayne Smith speaking at a tribunal on Luis Posada Cardiles at New York University Law School. We'll be right back.
In his recent book, Collateral Damage, America's War Against Iraqi Civilians, which Chris Hedges wrote with Laila Al-Aryan, he exposes the dark violence of the Iraqi war, the kind of violence and eyewitness accounts you won't hear in the U.S. media. His book pulls together the hundreds of hours of stories from combat veterans who describe a day-to-day carnage more explicit than the Vietnam War. Chris is a journalist and author of many books specializing in American and Middle Eastern politics and society. He spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. And right now, he's a senior fellow at the Nation Institute in New York City and a lecturer in the Council of the Humanities.
Chris Hedges, we're pleased to have you again at Law and Disorder. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
So, Chris, I know you have a relatively new book called Collateral Damage, America's War Against Iraqi Civilians, and it's done with another occasional guest, Laila Al-Aryan, who is on Law and Disorder now and then. But can you give us, I think, two things we want to do. One is some sense of that book, and then go to some of your thoughts about where we are in Iraq right now.
It came out of a seven-month investigative piece that Laila and I did, where we interviewed 50 combat veterans from the war in Iraq, all on the record. Every interview was taped. And these interviews ran hours, you know, 4 or 5 hours at a sitting, and we often went back for more. And it was an attempt to explain on the street level what the war was like for Iraqi civilians. Now, of course, the best way to do that is to go into Iraq and spend time in Iraqi neighborhoods and interview Iraqi civilians. But because of the security situation, that's become impossible to do. Reporters can only spend about 15, 20 minutes in any one locale before they move on. And then there's the trust factor and everything else. So we wanted to give people a window into the sheer terror that has been visited on Iraqi civilians since the occupation and invasion of their country. Now, you know, I spent many years covering conflicts. I'm very familiar with weapons systems. I'm very familiar with the various types of conflicts that there are, all of which I've covered. You know, you had the civil wars, for instance, that I covered in Central America. You had set mechanized battle that took place in the first Gulf War in the open desert, although, of course, many Iraqi civilians were killed in the bombing of southern Iraq before the invasion of Kuwait. And then you have foreign occupation, where foreign forces come in from the outside and really, you know, are historically, linguistically, politically, socially illiterate, and speak only the language of force, and attempt to impose their will by force. You see it in Gaza. You saw it in the French and Algeria. It's what we did in Vietnam, and it's what we're doing, of course, in Iraq and Afghanistan. And these kinds of foreign occupations are always the dirtiest, messiest, and most venal, because you're fighting an elusive enemy who you very rarely see. Every time you leave the perimeter of your base, you are in a sea of hostility, and there becomes what Robert J. Lifton, the psychiatrist, calls these kinds of conflicts. He was writing about the war in Vietnam, but it's very apropos to Iraq. These kinds of conflicts he calls atrocity-producing situations. And by that he means that, especially after units begin to suffer casualties and mortalities, that it becomes a very short psychological leap from defining hostile civilians. You're no longer able to distinguish between a hostile civilian population and the enemy. They all become the enemy, and they all become a legitimate target.
Yeah, I'm interested in that. In interviewing the 50 people, I think it was 50 former Iraq vets, is that what came out of those interviews?
Yeah, because you have a situation. We tried to look at the pillars of the occupation, you know, those structures that are probably most important to holding up the occupation structure. So that was checkpoints, raids, detentions, convoys, all of the factors where normal Iraqis come into daily contact with occupation forces and what that means for Iraqis. So rather than sort of ramble on, and we focused very tightly, very closely, with great detail on these particular pillars and described how they worked. You know, for instance, convoys. Convoys are something that every Iraqi almost every day is going to confront at one point or another. Convoys, which, you know, six, seven, sometimes longer rows of armored vehicles, armored Humvees, sometimes protecting trucks and tankers, roaring down Iraqi roads 50, 60 miles an hour. Of course, stopping or any kind of static movement, inability to move is very dangerous, and so they will jump the meridian or drive down the center of the meridian, go into oncoming traffic, smash into Iraqi vehicles. If they have to push them out of the way, run over Iraqi civilians, including children. Everybody we interviewed either witnessed that or heard of it or knew of it. And then if an IED, an improvised explosive device, goes off, or if they come under an ambush, they lay down absolutely withering, suppressing fire with belt-fed saws. These are light 7.62 machine guns, automatic grenade launchers, sometimes 50 calibers. These are very potent weapons in very densely populated areas, and don't stick around to find out what damage they did and what human life they took.
I want to remind our listeners we're speaking with Chris Hedges, co-author of Collateral Damage, America's War Against Iraqi Civilians, co-author with Leila El Arian.
Chris, I just wanted you to continue on. This is really gripping with the explanation of what happened at checkpoints and what happened at raids, what happened in detentions.
You know, raids are, again, a ubiquitous part of the occupation. You know, because they're flying blind, very poor intelligence, they're not integrated, the occupation forces are not integrated into the society very well. You know, when an IED goes off or when an ambush takes place, they will oftentimes that night cordon off an entire village or neighborhood, you know, dozens of houses, make a perimeter around it, burst into these homes at 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, guns drawn, corral the young men, any man of military age, into a room, handcuff them with plastic handcuffs, tear the place to shreds, looking for any kind of weapons or material that could be used to help the insurgents. There's a lot of theft, we heard. There's a lot of squabbling over who gets to go into the bedroom, because that's usually where the money and whatever gold or jewelry or anything they have of value is kept. And by the time they leave the place, the houses are just destroyed. They oftentimes will cart away the men who will disappear into the Iraqi prison system. Now, this kind of stuff goes on night after night after night. I mean, at this point, we're probably talking tens of thousands of Iraqi families have experienced this. And you can be pretty certain, as all these veterans said, that if these people didn't support the insurgents when they burst through their doors, they certainly did by the time they were finished.
So this is still going on as we speak today.
Yes.
Let me bring you forward a little bit. I know you've done a lot on Iraq. And, of course, it's fallen off a lot of the front pages, to put it mildly. You see occasional things. You see Petraeus leaving. You see claims about the surge working. You see possibly a new agreement being negotiated with the U.S. Is there an angle you want to address with Iraq right now when you talk to people about it?
Well, the fallacy that somehow the surge contributed to the decline in violence. That's because the whole country has been carved up into little fiefdoms of, you know, ethnically cleansed fiefdoms with blast walls. Baghdad doesn't exist as a unified city. Iraq doesn't exist as a unified country. And this, I think, disastrous decision to pay off the Sunni insurgents. So we have now 80 to 100,000 Sunni insurgents, these so-called awakening groups members, who get salaries of $300 a month. Well, look, the Sunnis, who are a minority in Iraq, dominated the regime of Saddam Hussein. They made up most of the officer corps, all of the intelligence agencies, all of the special forces and elite units. And what we've really allowed them to do by buying them off is come out of the shadows. And remember, these people have a lot of American blood on their hands. Come out of the shadows and constitute, in essence, a conventional military force. And they have the wherewithal, the training, and the knowledge to do that. They have nothing but hatred towards the central Shiite-dominated government. And if you watch the news closely, we've been seeing in the last few weeks a series of targeted assassinations against Sunni awakening members by a very nervous Shiite community run out of the Ministry of Interior. So there's been a kind of temporary lull. I mean, everybody talks about the surge, but the Anbar was sort of the prototype for buying off the insurgents, and Anbar got quiet before the surge came. The surge only had brought in 30,000 troops. Most of those people were in Baghdad. Baghdad itself, people are completely, Shiites, Kurds, Sunnis are completely now cut off from each other. They'll sort of throw mortars back and forth over the blast walls. But this has been a pact with the devil. It was a tactic, by the way, that was tried in Afghanistan and has failed, where money and even weapons were given to tribal groups to entice them away from the Taliban. Well, they now, when the money stopped or they got enough weapons, have gone right back into the arms of the Taliban. And we have a situation in Afghanistan where 50% of the country is now under Taliban control. When we went in there, it was about three quarters. So, you know, this has been politically expedient in the short term. But in the long term, what we've really done is essentially empowering and allowing Sunni forces to build a very potent vehicle to unleash a very brutal civil war, and it's coming.
Well, Chris Hedges, what would be your advice to the American anti-war movement with respect to policy in Iraq?
Oh, stop voting for Barack Obama. I mean, you know, and you've got to support a third-party candidate, whether it's McKinney or Nader, because Obama doesn't embrace complete withdrawal from Iraq. He talks about leaving behind troops in our imperial city, the Green Zone, and the super bases, and fighting terrorism, whatever that means, and training the Iraqi army. He wants to downsize in Iraq. Isn't going to work. And he wants to expand the war in Afghanistan. And I am very, very tired. I mean, look, this war under post-Nuremberg laws is an illegal, it's a criminal war of aggression. We have no right as citizens of this country to debate the terms of the occupation.
I think
that's
right.
And the left is just spineless, and I'm sick of it. You know, yeah. I mean, war is not an abstraction to me. Iraq is not an abstraction to me. I have friends in Baghdad. I have friends in Tehran. I have friends in Jerusalem. I have friends in Gaza. I at least want to go back and assure them that I did everything within my power to stand up. But unfortunately, Barack Obama speaks in the same language, toxic language of war, bequeathed to us by the Bush administration, including on Iran. I suppose you can rationalize it that somehow he's a stealth candidate. But as Dennis Kucinich says, you know, forget all the rhetoric. Look at the voting record. And he, along with the rest of the Democrats, have not, you know, after coming to power in 2006, not only voted to continue funding the war, but have voted to augment the troop levels. It's crazy.
I mean, the policies really are not very different between McCain and Obama on Iraq.
No, for,
not at all.
You know, the tragedy for the Palestinians and for the Iraqis and the Afghanis is that it really isn't going to make any difference whether Barack Obama or John McCain is president.
And so your recommendation, at least to the anti-war movement, is just it's an illegal war, immediate withdrawal, I presume, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the only argument that people make, which I think is specious about remaining, is, well, we have to remain because what would happen if we left? Well, that presupposes that we're a force for stability, that we're
right,
not
I,
just
right.
another agent for terror and violence in this cauldron, yeah. You know, along with the warlords and the death squads and the militias and the mercenary army and everything else.
Well, Chris, we heard that argument during Vietnam. How are you going to get out?
Right.
And the answer was in big boats.
Well, I get very tired with the failure on the left of this country to stand up for the values that, you know, I don't even want to get into FISA and everything else. FISA for me is crippling because I have constant contact with the Middle East. The FISA Reform Act is just one giant step towards fascism.
Yeah, we agree. You know, we at the center were part of the lawsuit.
I'm part of the ACLU.
I know you were part of a lawsuit as well, and we said we're all wiretapped. We contact people in the Mideast all the time.
I know, and Obama voted for it. And
I know.
I'm just not willing to give him a pass on this stuff. I mean, he's a smart guy. He knows very well how poisonous the FISA Reform Act is to the maintenance of an open society and especially a free press.
Reflecting on what you said, what Eugene V. Debs said famously, I'd rather vote for something I want and not get it than vote for something I don't want and get it.
Not only that, politics is a game of pressure. If a million Americans, as they did, you know, voted for Debs, if a million Americans got behind McKinney or Nader, the Democratic Party would start to freak out a little bit. But we just roll over and play dead every year. Believe me, they're getting a lot of pressure, as we can see with the bailout, from the other side. And until we draw a line and say, look, there's certain moral imperatives that we won't cross, which is what the Liberty Party did when they fought slavery, if you cross them, we're out. So, and we won't do that. And that's what's killed us and made us impotent.
Turn you to Afghanistan, if that's okay, Chris, for a second. I read an article in the paper about Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, asking the Saudis to help him negotiate with the Taliban. And then I heard another from a high-level UN guy who said, you know, I told the U.S., a year ago, that they have to get out of Afghanistan and let Karzai or whoever the government is begin negotiations with the Taliban. And what's happened in the years, the Taliban has gotten even stronger, and now they're going to demand more in a negotiation.
Yeah.
I don't know what your thinking is on that, but he was essentially saying to me, in the end, U.S. just gets out and let the Afghans deal with it themselves.
Well, and everyone forgets that we were negotiating with the Taliban initially when we were trying to get rid of Osama bin Laden. Karzai is, you know, he barely controls his own ministries in Kabul. So I think if anyone looks at the hard facts of the last 7 years of the occupation of Afghanistan, it's indisputable that is actually empowered the very forces that we went in there and tried to crush or defeat. The Taliban has risen from the ashes. Not only that, it's become very effective and very well financed with the mushrooming of the poppy trade and the heroin trade, which they tax. They tax the farmers of war tax and use it to fund the insurgency. And that's why we're bombing indiscriminately all over the place, village after village, because we lack the troops to go in there. We don't control on the ground. That kind of lashing out is very counterproductive, and it's turning Afghans who suffered under the Taliban and were not predisposed towards the Taliban against us. This year alone, civilian deaths in Afghanistan have risen by 2/3, and the year's not over yet. So if you think Iraq is bad, I can assure you that Afghanistan is completely hopeless. You wonder if anybody reads history. The Soviets threw 100,000 troops in there, 15,000 dead, 10-year war, or go back and read about the British in the 19th century.
Right.
This is just folly. And again, you have a situation where the so-called anti-war movement in this country is sort of carrying the banner for Obama while he gets up and publicly calls for a ratcheting up of the war in Afghanistan.
And Chris, with respect to Pakistan and the raids they've recently launched there, which has been given support by the critics of the government, what do you think of that?
So very similar to Cambodia, you know, what we did in the Vietnam War. And it's true. I mean, look, all successful insurgencies have neighboring countries with sanctuaries. That's how it works. But what did we just have a drone kill, what was it, 7 Afghanis? It's shredding Pakistan, which is not a particularly coherent country anyway. It is essentially spreading the war beyond the Afghan borders and is very dangerous in terms of a stable Pakistan, but also presages a wider war. And that's precisely what happened in Laos and Cambodia during the Vietnam War.
Exactly. Chris Hedges, the author of a recent book, Collateral Damage, America's War Against Iraqi Civilians, which he wrote with Laila Al-Arian. Chris, can you estimate for us just exactly how extensive the murdering and maiming of the Iraqi civilians has been?
It's in the hundreds of thousands, we know. I think that's a pretty safe figure. Lancet, what, 2-3 years ago, figured 600,000. Some numbers are now up to 1.2 million. You know, those are caused by car bombs, by Shiite death squads, by kidnapping rings. You know, it's everything together. But we certainly have a hefty percentage of those deaths lie at the feet of American troops.
So they've dismantled and destroyed this ancient civilization. Why? Why do you think the Bush administration went into Iraq to begin
with? Because they're utopians. You know, I don't think we think of Dick Cheney as a utopian, but he is. And I, you know, use the word utopia as it was meant to be, as coined by Thomas More in 1518. Utopia literally means no place. It doesn't exist. And these people occupied a country and in a region they know nothing about and didn't want to know anything about. I mean, if you took all of the Arabists in this country, which is probably about 10,000 people, I mean, by that I mean people who speak Arabic and have lived for a prolonged period of time in the Arab world, I don't think you could have found more than about 10 or 15 that thought occupying Iraq was a good idea. And I include all the Arabists in the State Department, the intelligence community, and the Pentagon. You know, the idea that we would be greeted as liberators, the idea that democracy would be implanted in Baghdad and emanate outwards across the Middle East, the idea that the oil revenues would pay for reconstruction. This was utopian. It was a non-reality-based belief. Anybody who came out of the region, and especially out of Iraq, realized that this was absurd. But unfortunately, these people live in a non-reality-based world, a world of their own creation. And I think they were true believers. I know they were true believers because I was on the, you know, on the New York Times investigative team, and I had to listen to people like Judy Miller mouth this kind of garbage.
Chris, I just want, not a question, I just have a contribution to this discussion, Chris Hedges. Are you aware that Thomas More left lawyers out of his utopia?
Yeah, I am, actually. Yeah. that's another show.
Absolutely.
He would have accepted Michael.
Maybe.
Right? We would have given him a pass.
Now, Chris, any last words? I mean, you know, I must say, listening to you, it's strong, it's accurate, and it's angry. Where do we find even a little bit of optimism in it?
Well, I went to seminary. I never went to journalism school. And the guy I'm supposed to model my life on was turned on by all his friends, beaten by the mob, and left on a cross to die. there's a great theologian who said, well, what's the message of the crucifixion? It's that if you don't love, you die, and if you do, they kill you. I think optimism comes, or, you know, for me, spirituality, a word that's become completely corrupted, and I think, it really is just a cover for a kind of American narcissism, is about resistance, that we find our true spiritual worth in our ability to resist and to take moral stances, no matter how lonely they may be and no matter how much the world around us may crumble, that's what faith is, that there's a belief in the end that it's worthwhile, even when all the empirical evidence says otherwise. I think that is the advantage with coming out of a religious tradition, because I'm one person, I can't do much, but I at least have moral imperatives that I will cling to and fight for, even if no one around me will join me.
Well, we really appreciate that last comment, Chris. I think that's right. I mean, as having stood there alone in many, many causes, it gives me great strength to hear you.
Thank you
so much, Chris
Hedges. We really appreciate your being on Law and Disorder. You've written Collateral Damage, America's War Against Iraqi Civilians with Leila Ararian. We urge everybody to go out and get it. Chris Hedges, one of the great voices of our time.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Chris.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.